This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Frequently, we hear the topic of an imminent collapse of the U.S. dollar. Okay, I'll bite. What happens if the dollar does, quote, collapse, end quote? What does that mean in real terms? Funny you should ask that question. Well, actually, I asked it, but theoretically, we all asked it together, because that's the subject of the big picture today. And our guest is Lionel Shriver. Jim, take it away.
In 2029, the United States is engaged in a bloodless world war that will wipe out the savings of millions of American families. Overnight, on the international currency exchange, the almighty dollar plummets in value to be replaced by a new global currency, the bancor. In retaliation, the president declares that America will default on its loans. The government prints money to cover its bills. What little real currency remains for savers is rapidly eaten away by runaway inflation. And that's the theme and premise of a new book called The Mandibles by author Lionel Shriver. And Lionel joins me now. Lionel, just out of curiosity, I was reading a bunch of books about central banking, about this unusual monetary policy that the world has been going through in the last 7 or 8 years. What was the inspiration of this book? Because you're taking a look forward, going out maybe 15 years from now, less than 15, of the ultimate conclusion if we keep going along this path of debt. George W. Bush doubled the national debt in his presidency. President Obama has doubled the debt in his presidency. So we're close to $20 trillion. What was the inspiration for this?
Well, to begin with, of course, what happened in 2008, but my impression once the dust settled on that one was that we had brushed up against a kind of international collapse that we ultimately escaped. My worry was that we didn't actually escape it, but simply delayed it. We, as the British are very fond of saying, kicked the can down the road. And we're more indebted as a world economy than we've ever been, and that includes the lead up to 2008. So the situation just gets worse. And on a nonfiction level, once I started turning to the issue in earnest, I became concerned that since we have moved from a banking crisis to a sovereign debt crisis, which continues to get worse, and we're also looking at a demographic future which puts huge burdens on government to provide escalating entitlements for my own generation. I mean, at what point are we going to start paying down the principal? I'm not sure that we're ever planning to pay down the principal, which just gets bigger and bigger. If that's the case, that means that what look like assets on balance sheets now are actually debts. Any debt that is never going to be repaid is not real money. So if we're not going to ever pay this back, we have based an entire international monetary system on a fraudulence. It means that money itself becomes a pyramid scheme. And at a certain point, all pyramid schemes collapse.
You know, it's amazing because I think voters, citizens around the globe have no concept of the unusual circumstances we find ourselves in today. I mean, I'm looking at a Bloomberg screen of the bond market. And as I look at the bond market, we have negative yields.
Which is surreal. You know, I have a hard time wrapping my head around negative interest rates. But I think that this whole zero interest rate environment means that capitalism is not functional. The trouble is that zero interest suits government and a lot of individuals down to the ground. And that's why there's no end in sight. But it doesn't work, because if you can infinitely create money and infinitely borrow money for no cost, effectively, it means there is no incentive to constrain the money supply, and there's no reason not to just borrow infinitely. I mean, why earn any money? Why not just borrow it? It's that just on a capitalistic level, on a systemic level, that is unsustainable.
Well, that's where we find ourselves today, with the Bank of England actually paying its banks money to loan money. I think you and I would all like to be in that kind of business. I mean, imagine that. And, you know, Lyle, one of the things that we've also seen recently is not just sovereigns. We are now seeing large corporations in Europe that are now issuing bonds with negative interest rates because people are looking, institutions, pensions, are looking for a place to park large amounts of capital. Corporations are sitting on over $2 trillion in cash. Where are you going to put that money? So you have to put it in something semi-safe. So they put it in sovereigns or, who knows, the negative interest rates of large corporations. As you develop this story, you're going out to the year 2029. At that point, there's an international crisis. And in response to that crisis, the dollar begins to plunge on a daily basis. This kind of reminds me, Lionel, of what we saw in the late 70s with the dollar, where we were seeing 14% inflation rates. We were seeing interest rates approach 15% until Paul Volcker came in and started to tighten the reins on inflation. But in your story, I guess the debt keeps accumulating, and now we're having a trust issue with the dollar, and international entities are proposing a bancor. Now, for our listeners who may not have heard of that, the bancor is sort of this quasi-currency right now that the IMF is using.
In some ways, I mean, I also got the idea from John Maynard Keynes. That's actually his expression, the bancor. So I would just lifted that from him. And it was conceptually going back to a kind of currency that is based on something. So instead of being based on gold, it's based on a basket of commodities like corn and wheat and oil. But it is a non-fiat currency.
So when this story develops, you have a president of the United States that overnight devalues the currency in effect and basically defaults on all its debt. And, you know, we rarely see that with major countries. We've seen it in Argentina. We've seen it in Russia.
And it's happening in Greece. I mean, all that business of calling it restructuring or whatever, that's default. And Greece is systematically defaulting on its debt. I don't expect Greece to ever pay back its debt. But you're right. It's not commonplace for countries to actually announce that that's what they're doing. What they more frequently do is simply print money and erode the debt by inflation. But the fact is that eroding the debt by inflation is a form of default, you know, so that you are paying back money you borrowed. The money that you borrowed was worth something. You pay it back with money that hugely depreciated. It's still cheating. It's still not keeping the contract. And if I was going to criticize my plot, I would say that going the inflation rate is more likely in the United States than an absolute renunciation. That said, even Donald Trump has mooted the idea of so-called renegotiating the national debt, which means it defaulting on at least part of it. But either way, you know, we are now sitting at $19 trillion and rising, and I just don't see the U.S. paying it back.
Well, you know, it's rather interesting. I follow the national debt and the government's balance sheet each year, and here we are, at least in 2015, the fiscal year. We're soon to end 2016 here at the end of this month. But in 2015, Lionel, the government had almost $8.6 trillion more in debt, and yet it was paying $50 billion less in interest. So the government has benefited from these zero and negative interest rates, unlike savers who have been harmed. But at what point do you think, or will it take an event, where the market wakes up and demands a higher rate of return on invested capital? Because right now, the governments are benefiting from it. The markets seem to like it. But as we have seen in this presidential campaign, and as you make reference to the debt, and also in your book as well, there's no candidate, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, that are talking about balancing the budget. In fact, they're all talking about spending vast sums of new money. One party wants to lower taxes, spend money on the infrastructure and the military. The other candidate wants to start new social programs when I don't think the public is aware that last year, to save the disability fund, they had to make cuts indirectly to Social Security and move funds over to make it solvent for 1 year.
Well, there's not really much in it for presidential candidates to talk about the national debt. I mean, I'm afraid that what's happened is so far we've got away with it. So it means we're spending money we don't have. But that's fun, you know? That's like, oh, great. We don't have to raise taxes, and we can have big government. And so far, there's no penalty to pay. And we can keep borrowing huge amounts of money. We're not going to pay it back, and we don't have to pay anything to borrow that money. You know, it's a kind of fantasy land. And the trouble is, with large complex systems that may be growing inherently unstable, they can still perk along for quite some time until some little thing trips the catastrophe. And I think that since we haven't had that catastrophe, not on the scale that I'm talking about and that you're talking about, then the ordinary citizen is like, okay, well, I guess that's not a problem. And it's only when it's up in your face and too late that it seems like a problem. The other trouble is it doesn't actually matter how informed you are. I mean, you and I read this stuff for entertainment, if nothing else, but does it mean that we have any control? No. I mean, these things are bigger than we are. And even if you've got the whole country up in arms about the national debt, what are they going to do about it? Because the only answer is to cut back entitlements that people have become accustomed to believe is a human right, like Medicare and Social Security. So that's not popular. And I don't know what the answer is. That's actually been one of the frustrations of publishing this novel, which has a cautionary element to it, obviously. But, you know, I was asked in an event not long ago, so what am I suggesting we do? You know, what should ordinary people do? And I honestly had no answer. I have no idea what ordinary people can do. And as you point out, you know, one of the only things we can do is vote. But for whom can we vote in this presidential election that does anything about this? You're right. Neither candidate is offering to do anything about the deficit, much less the debt itself.
Well, the one thing that we have learned in history is that bubbles can take place and last much longer than most people believe. And this is something, in my opinion, that we're seeing now in sovereign debt markets. Just when the markets thought interest rates were going up, they actually went lower and then went negative universally. In your book, the new president of the United States is Hispanic. The country is primarily Hispanic as the majority population at that time by 2029.
Actually, they're more like a third, which is what we're on track to achieve. But electorally, that still gives them a lock on the White House because they're the swing vote. We're seeing that already. So that's why I thought that electing a Latino president by 2029 was credible.
In your story, as you develop, the president defaults on debt and the Great Renunciation, as it's called in your novel. It does a number of things. It not only, you know, when Nixon went off the gold standard, Americans applauded it. Gosh, those greedy foreigners that wanted our gold. But in effect, when a government like the United States or any government for that matter defaults on its debt, Lionel, it hurts not only foreigners that hold the debt, but also U.S. citizens, because you have citizens that have 401ks, they're invested in government bond funds, there are a lot of government bond funds out there, a lot of debt that is held by the American public, there's pension plans, there's insurance companies, and this really devastates Americans in so many ways. It's not just the fact with devaluation and the collapse of the dollar, money has no purchasing value, but at the same time, the investments, because in this novel of yours, there is this family, the Mandibles, and the senior Mandible has a considerable fortune, and many of his siblings are kind of relying on or thinking that, you know, someday down the future, when the old man dies, because he's in his 90s, they will inherit a considerable fortune. But in this case, he loses a lot. And talk about, too, something that Roosevelt did in 1933 is he confiscated American gold at $20 an ounce, revalued it at $35. When the president in your novel renounces debt, he also
confiscates gold, and unlike the past, that also includes jewelry. In military personnel go house to house with metal detectors looking for it.
One of the things that I learned in doing the research for this book was about the confiscation of gold held in private hands by FDR in 1933. And I have to say, as an American citizen who fancied herself reasonably well educated, I was shocked at myself that this was news to me. I'd never read about it before. And furthermore, the legislation to allow the president to commandeer all of our gold is still on the books. It's one of the things that people who invest in gold tend to be under aware of. And actually, in my novel, just as FDR did, the gold is purchased at undervalue. So it's also a money-making scheme. Although you find out later in the novel that one of the reasons they want the gold is to pay off China and to keep China from basically declaring war on the country. So it was important to me to tell the story in this novel, the background, future history, in a way that was economically credible. I tried to make it as realistic as possible. The only aspect of the plot economically, which I would personally question, is that in my novel, the U.S. economy implodes, but it doesn't take the rest of the world with it. And at least as things stand now, I think that's optimistic. I did that just because I wasn't interested in writing a novel about international economic collapse. It was just a bigger bite than I cared to chew. But otherwise, I wanted that history to scan. And I wanted someone who is pretty up to speed on economics, as you seem to be, to find the sequence of events that I put together plausible. That said, I thought it was important to tell the story from the perspective of ordinary people. So that's why I focused on the family, and they're really in the foreground. In the same way that, you know, we all live our personal lives in the foreground of our own lives, and then the newspaper is in the background. But at the same time, the things that are going on in the newspaper often have a direct effect on what our personal lives are like, and that's certainly the case with major economic paroxysms. And I chose to talk about a family that had some wealth in it, partly because you have to have something to lose it. So if I were writing about people who were strapped or in debt, then they wouldn't see their savings dissolve. I have to say, just on a kind of prissy moral level, I'm very sympathetic with savers, with people who put something aside, who expect to cover their own retirements, who don't expect other people to take care of them, have tried to be responsible. And I see that in our current economic environment, we are punishing the very people that we should be rewarding. And it's debtors who are getting away scot-free, including, of course, our own government.
In this book, as chaos sort of breaks loose because money has no purchasing power, the government's confiscating, this wealthy family starts to go through some hard times. Describe a little bit about how, in this process, when this happens, civil order begins to break down. In fact, in this case, basically, one member of the family loses their house as somebody accosts them with a weapon and forces them to move out, and they become like homeless victims that we see so many places around in cities around the country. Talk about this civil disorder that happens when you do default on debt, when you do devalue a currency. It breaks up the norms of an operating economy.
Well, I tried to have that social disorder deteriorate quite slowly at first, and I think that's accurate. When things fall apart, they often take a while to ruin your life. So that at the very beginning, one of my characters is especially distressed that it's become almost impossible to find imported extra virgin olive oil. But little by little, it's not on that level anymore. It's not that you can't buy olive oil, you can't keep your job. And if you can't keep your job, you can't keep your house. And when everyone is experiencing stress all at once, you lose that, oh, I'll help you out because you're having a hard time mentality, and people withdraw more and more to protecting the interests of their own family, and it becomes increasingly Darwinian. You know, we like to think of ourselves as civilized, decent people, and we obey the law, and then there's this little group of criminals who don't toe the line, and we try to keep them under control. But when civil order really breaks down, we all become criminals. You start breaking the rules just in order to survive. So that at that point in the novel that the Mandibles are ejected from the only house they've got left at gunpoint, they're ejected by somebody who used to work for Columbia University. You know, it's not some hood who's been a lifelong criminal. And that's the big change. So basically, we've all got it in us to be hoods if it's a matter of finding food and shelter.
I want to bring up something also that you introduce in your novel, and it's a play on future technology. Explain this device. What is it? Is it called the Flex? Or it's a type of device that everybody uses to communicate. It can shrink. It can get larger. Describe where the thought of that came from, because it's not too far in the future.
Well, I was just trying to solve the few problems with our current devices that I have. For example, that we have so many of them. You've got your phone, you've got your tablet, you've got your laptop. Some people even also have a desktop, though I think they're going the way of the horse and buggy. So I combine them all in one. Everyone has one device. It's called a Flex. And the other thing I don't like about these devices is that they're a little too fragile. That whole thing of your phone screen breaking all the time. This one will stiffen into a screen the size of your choosing, but when you relax it, it becomes almost like a tissue. You can wad it up in your pocket. And in fact, the early versions that didn't have distinctive colors, people were constantly throwing away because they mistook them for Kleenex. That's just me having fun. And also, it's me adhering to the rules of the form. I mean, you know, when you set a book in the future, then you have to change the technology a little. But otherwise, I wasn't interested in, especially in writing science fiction per se. So I'd say that the technological innovation that I brought to bear on 2029 is fairly modest. I invented a few things, but for the most part, I went with technological innovations that are already in the pipeline. You know, I don't expect you to fall off your chair at the prospect of driverless electric cars. They're already in the works. And that's deliberate. You know, I want you to be bored with that because I'm looking at a story that focuses on money.
You know what was interesting in your book, because one of your characters has a job working at this kind of center, is the tax rate of the country is 77%. So basically, you earn a dollar, 77% of it goes to the government in various forms of taxes, and you keep 23%. How does one survive under those circumstances?
Very badly. You know, the end of the book, which ends in 2047, is looking at very real, likely statistics, particularly in relation to the support ratio, meaning how many workers are supporting one retired person or child or unemployed person. And I'm looking at a support ratio of about 1 to 1. And that's horrifying. That means taxes have to be through the roof. So that my 77% tax rate is not ridiculous. The trouble is that that sends workforce participation into a spiral. Because when you keep so little of your own money, what motivation do you have to work in the first place? The young people who are working in my book are working 3 jobs and have nothing to show for it. You know, what I'm about there is I'm illustrating what the economic future could look like given the demographics, especially since my generation is supposed to live such long lives, which is, you know, we may think that's great, but it's economically disastrous.
So as you look at all these strains that are put on the public, what was amazing is one of the members of this family is kind of a little bit out there to the rest of the family. He gets into organic farming, kind of a survivalist. But even though in the beginning he does well, the government in the middle of the 30s, as your novel progresses, comes in and basically nationalizes all the farms and takes over agriculture because of starving cities.
I thought that was credible too. I mean, one of the things that we underappreciate, especially in this country, because we're always talking about freedom, is the fact that government can do anything it wants. And when you consider that, it's terrifying. What I'm especially focusing on is that we have already given to government, with the advent of income tax, the ability to take up to 100% of our money. And when the government completely controls your money, I don't think we're free. I don't think that's a liberty worth having, especially toward the end of the book, with very, very high tax rates and a little chip in the back of everyone's head that subtracts your money at source. You become this walking credit card from which the government can subtract your assets at will. I'm looking at specifically at the nature of financial tyranny. There have been a couple of reviews that mischaracterized the latter part of the novel as the U.S. becoming a police state. And that's not the idea. The idea is that it has become tyrannical specifically in relation to your financial assets. But that is tyranny. When you do not control your finances, if the government controls your money, the government also controls your ability to survive. And that makes you a slave.
As this novel starts to unfold, eventually it gets a little bit better for the family, but there is a movement within the country, and you chose the state of Nevada, that basically the people in Nevada said, we've had enough, and they go independent and they secede from the nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that you mentioned that, because there has been some talk in various states around the country, Texas being one of them, of that very thought.
I thought that if you were going to have any state secede from the nation, Nevada was the most likely candidate. They have the right attitude. It's a state full of renegades, and I say that affectionately.
So as this novel unfolds, towards the end, the family sort of comes together, and the family is saved by the holdings of one of the older sisters who lived abroad. She was an author. And she had gold holdings, gold bars, that she was able to get into the country. So in the end, gold, I can't imagine what the value of gold is under these chaotic situation. But apparently it was enough to save the family and give it a new start.
Well, now no one needs to read the book because we have told the entire plot. I mean, I'm not that much of a gold bug. There's nothing rational about the idea that gold maintains its value while fiat currencies don't. Yes, it's limited in quantity, but it's also of limited utility. So I don't quite understand why the gold standard works, but it did seem to work better than what we've got now. So as I have a character say near the end of the book in explaining how the United States of Nevada works, they use the gold standard, conceding that it's stupid and arbitrary. But because it has worked in the past, why not go with it? After all, Nevada has more gold reserves than I think any other state in the nation.
Well, that's where most of the mining of gold occurs in this country.
And it was convenient for my plot to have a portable substance that ends up being worth a lot of money. I mean, that would have to be gold. The whole thing with gold, I don't get it. I don't get where it works. I don't get why it continues to be such a reliable store of value in times of crisis. It is still an arbitrary store of value, and you can't do that much with it but make pretty things. So I see why rare earths would be important, because they're vital in the construction of our precious devices. So long as we're dependent on fossil fuels, it makes sense to treasure oil. But I don't see privileging gold. I don't get it. But somehow, because it has been a store of value for 5,000 years, it seems to be what people retreat to in times of crisis, which is why it's used conventionally now as a hedge in most portfolios.
One of the most hated government agencies in this country is the IRS. It's intrusion into people's lives. Sometimes there are high-handedness. In your book, the IRS morphs into a new bureau called the Bureau for Social Contribution Assistance. I love that.
And everyone calls it instead the Social Contribution Assistance Bureau, and the acronym is SCAB. And the people who work for the newly rebranded IRS are called scabbies. Not nice. But I thought the one point that one of the characters makes about the new IRS is that it was a little mysterious how underfunded the IRS used to be. And when it morphs into the biggest part of government, it makes perfect sense. I mean, why isn't the IRS one of the biggest agencies in government? It is out there to steal your money. So it's in government interest for that entity to be extremely well-funded. And I find it interesting, the way things are currently constructed, that the IRS is strapped for funds.
So as you look at this, and we have the Bureau of Contribution Assistance, also because of the way things develop, we also go to a cashless society. So now, in essence, the government has control over everything you do, including the chip that everybody must take that's embedded in the back of their skull.
That was another one of those little technological changes that, again, draws on what is virtually possible already. And the chip is embedded at the back of your neck in order to make it difficult to dig it out, because there's a very high likelihood that even if you get a surgeon to do it, that you will end up a paraplegic. That's why it's put right up against the spinal column. I thought it was worth drawing people's attention to the fact that this cashless society that we're rapidly advancing toward, I mean, I do encounter articles that think that cash is going to be completely defunct within the next 20 years. It's worth considering that that means there's a paper trail for absolutely everything you spend and everything you earn. Cash is the only form of money that eludes jurisdiction. And if we do move to the point where there is no such thing as a physical dollar, that means that you live in a universe where the government potentially, if it wants to, can track everything you do in relation to money.
So as this continues, and of course, this story progresses, as you have in your book jacket, from 2029 to 2047. What I thought was interesting geopolitically is that the U.S. is weakened militarily. So one of the reasons it confiscates gold is China owns so much of the country. It was to pay China in gold to avoid a war. And in, I think, some part of your book, Russia, basically, as they've been invading, as we've seen them in the Ukraine and in the Balkans, they basically annex Alaska, which they sold to us in the 19th century.
That's right. And I have China annexing Japan and Indonesia annexing Australia. Now, some of this stuff is just kind of fun, but I am making a serious point, which is the U.S. quite justly resent paying for all this military adventuring abroad. And, of course, foreigners often resent our butting our noses into their business. But on the other side, the very presence of the U.S. with the size of its military and its at least idea of itself as a virtuous entity acts as a check on other countries' more malign intentions. And if the U.S. no longer had the financial wherewithal to project itself militarily into the rest of the world, and no other halfway responsible country took our place, we'd live in a much more dangerous world. So as much as I am skeptical of many of the military interventions during my lifetime, I have a sense that there are a lot of other things that just haven't happened because countries know that they would suffer the consequences from the U.S. So I'm saying that as much as other countries often resent us, they would miss us if we cleared off.
You know, one thing I'd love to ask you, when you begin a story like this, obviously it starts somewhere, a formulation in your mind about this story. Take me, if you would, how this developed and how it eventually became a novel. In other words, did you start thinking of this idea, you started writing down notes, and you start formulating it? Take us behind the scenes a little bit, what it's like to be an author and develop a novel and story like yours.
I tend to plan my novels out in advance, not in extreme detail, because making up the little stuff along the way is a lot of the fun. But I have a general sense of where the novel is going. I usually know the ending ahead of time. People often find that disappointing. I'm not one of those writers who thinks that the characters have a life of their own and do whatever they independently decide to do. My characters do what they're told. But I don't start a book until I can kind of hold it in my head, almost like a sculpture. I think what I reserve for the writing process is refining what I'm trying to say, and that becomes a lot of the project. It's not just getting the story taking over, and of course that's vital, and the characters fully developed and reasonably consistent in their behavior, but also deciding what is the thrust here. So this book allowed me to go on any number of reflections, often through the characters, of course, about money, about people's relationship to it. What is it? What does it mean to us? Or what does it mean to different characters? Why do we want it? Now, for example, I have my doppelganger, who is exactly my age and by 2047 is 90 years old at that point. She ends up having to accept that basically everything that she wants, money can't buy, you know, that by that age, what you most of all want is security. And the entire novel is an illustration of the fact that money is insecure. So money itself is insecure. Therefore, it cannot buy security. But it also can't buy her a longer life. It can't buy her out of illness and infirmity. It can't restore her youth. It can't give her more inspiration for her novels. And I think that's worth thinking about. I mean, that's kind of the counter argument to the novel. It's a book very absorbed with money, but at the same time, it's worth taking a look at the limits of money. It's actually astonishing how little money can actually purchase. And it's also worth considering that money itself has no value, that it is only worth something when it is converted to something else. But its very potential, its very amorphousness, means that we project onto it all the things that we want, in spite of the fact that for the most part, most of those things, like love or respect, money is incapable of providing us.
You've written other books that have done well, The Big Brother, The Post-Birthday World. Were they similar theme as you developed in The Mandibles, or was this really one that stood out and is separate based on just how you see the world and studying money and what's going on now? Because we really do live in extraordinary times.
All of my novels have different agendas. So, you know, I haven't been writing about economic matters obsessively. My fifth novel, A Perfectly Good Family, is about an inheritance dispute between three grown siblings. And so that has an economic element. And my ninth novel, So Much for That, is about another couple caught up in the throes of the American healthcare system. And, of course, that has a whole lot to do with money, alas. So it is a theme that has cropped up before in my work because I'm very interested in people's relationship to finance and also the way in which money can interfere between people. That relationship between father and son in The Mandibles, where the son has been waiting all his life to finally inherit the fortune, is profoundly corrupted because the son is never quite sure whether he dotes on his father and goes to his assisted living facility over and over again because he loves his father and values his father's company, or he's actually just protecting his interests and making sure that his father doesn't have some late life conversion to giving the entire fortune to endow a chair at Yale. You know, it's only when the money goes away that that relationship becomes pure, and he realizes that he loves his father. But he also stops treating the guy with kid gloves, and they have a much realer relationship. So I'm interested in that, and I think that that kind of corruption between parent and child is quite commonplace. I expect people to recognize it. So it's a great theme, and I probably will return to it before my career is over. And I think that novelists of my generation have neglected the financial in their work. I often get frustrated when I'm reading other people's novels, and they don't quite add up economically. You know, they're a school teacher, and they have an apartment in the West Village. Excuse me. So I'm always conscious when I'm writing a novel that making the financial aspect of my characters' lives scan is important. And I think it's only recently that novelists like me have turned to larger economic issues. I mean, actually, someone like Dickens wrote about economics all the time. You know, the workhouses, debtors' prisons. He was very concerned with what we would call today income inequality. So I think there's plenty of precedent for literature engaging with these issues.
So, Lionel, as you look at this story as it unfolds, and especially given what we've seen, and by the way, is unrealistic, it may seem to people in the present, that something like this can happen. All you have to do presently is take a look at what's going on in Venezuela today, or what happened to Argentina in the last decade. But is there anything that would happen that would ever change your outlook that something like this could indeed unfold? For example, we get a new presidential candidate somewhere down the road, maybe not this election, because they're both about spending money and expanding entitlements, but maybe we get into a short-term crisis, and all of a sudden there's a candidate that can wake the country up. Is there anything like that that could happen that would change your outlook?
You mean someone got elected who was taking the national debt seriously and had a completely different idea of how to run the country? I mean, I suppose that's possible. But as we were discussing earlier, it would have to be after a crisis.
I agree.
It would have to make the way things are organized now seem obviously unsustainable and impossible, and everything's going to collapse. It's like 2008 concentrated minds on regulation of the banking industry, although I'm not sure that it was very effective. But at least for a time, it seemed as if it was crucial that something change, because things were falling apart. My worry is that things are now capable of falling apart on such a level that there's no remedy. You know, you can't just elect another president and he'll fix it. I think this is bigger than a single government. I think this is bigger than government. I return to the powerlessness that I was expressing earlier in this interview, which I feel profoundly. And I guess on a personal level, if I'm honest, I'm less consumed with campaigning for a remedy to this situation, because I'm not sure there is one, then I am just crossing my fingers that the collapse that I anticipate either happens later than I'm worried it will, or I die sooner. I don't want to live through it.
Well, it is certainly an ominous outlook when you take a look at this, as I imagine, and I see it right now. Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is watch some of the film clips and stories of what's going on in Venezuela today with hyperinflation going on.
I follow that story very closely, because partly it's like reading my novel unfold somewhere else. But I should emphasize, I hope I'm wrong. It's always fun to be right, or usually, but this time I would love to be wrong. And one of the nice things about both writing and reading a book that is apocalyptic about the future is that it is a safe space, if you will, to explore your fears without their coming to pass. So you can curl up with this book and think about these issues and explore an imaginary future in which things fall apart. But then you can put the book down and pour yourself a glass of wine and turn on the latest episode of Girls and put your feet up and open the chips. I guess part of the message of my novel is, okay, I'm not sure the center is going to hold in future, But so long as things are still pretty orderly, why don't we enjoy the fruits of civilization while we still have them?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a fascinating novel. It was one of five books I read during my August recess. The other four were about central banking and also financial crises. And it was sort of a nice way to end with a novel. It was very well done. And Lionel, I'd love to compliment you on it.
Well, thank you. And you just did. And I really appreciate it. I'm glad that I perked up your August.
You certainly did. As I mentioned, it was recommended by a friend of mine, and I dearly enjoyed reading it. The name of the book is called The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047, written by Lionel Shriver, who has been my guest. Lionel, thanks for joining me on the Financial Sense News Hour, and all the best with this book. I highly recommend reading it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You know, it was an interesting interview with Lionel Shriver. I was listening to it rather carefully because nowadays, Jim, you hear a lot of discussion about the, quote, imminent collapse of the dollar. Of course, the imminent collapse of the dollar has been imminent for almost 10 years now, so it's not quite as imminent as this seems to be. But when I ask people, well, what do you mean by that, the collapse of the dollar? Do you mean it loses all value? It's the world's currency of reserve right now. So, you know, I mean, have you thought all of this through as to how this is actually going to play out? I mean, a lot of these people think we're going back to the Stone Age or something, and back to bartering and trading gold and silver. So it was interesting to hear this because obviously she takes somewhat of a pessimistic view, but there is a future.
Yeah, there is a future. And of course, once again, this is a novel. And as you listen to the interview, it's a full length interview. It's almost an hour long. And it was one of my reading books. I read four books on central banking. Well, three books on central banking and then one on financial instability by Hyman Minsky. And the fifth one was The Mandibles. So it is interesting because we are going to be doing a show on those books I read about central banks and what it portends for the next financial crisis. That'll be coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.